$65 is even more disgraceful. That said, it makes a difference in, people's lives. In the lives of the top 1%ers, that wouldn't even cover the tip for an average dinner. And yet, many of the Social Security beneficiaries vote Republican. Figure that. And this from the Gila River Indian community. On March 5th of this year, the Federal Highways Administration released a record of decision in favor of building the South Mountain Freeway. The record of decision is a document that gives the Arizona Department of Transportation the approval to begin acquiring right of ways to begin construction on the 22-mile-long freeway that blasts straight through the Modoc-Loag South Mountain sacred area. That said, on that note, this has been Air Cascadia for Monday, March 16th, 2015. Kate Welch engineered the show for us today. Thanks, Kate. Kathleen Stevenson is the KBOO AM News and Public Affairs Director. I'm Chris Andre. Get the facts. Know your rights. Take a stand. Thanks for listening and stay tuned. Here comes Locus Focus.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Last Days in Vietnam, a film screening on Thursday, March 19th at Concordia University in Portland. Last Days in Vietnam is a new documentary from Rory Kennedy, which examines the final days of American presence in Saigon and the efforts taken to evacuate 135,000 South Vietnamese. Again, that's Last Days in Vietnam, Thursday, March 19th at 6 p.m. at the Hagen Building at Concordia University, 2811 Northeast Holman Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Wilkin and Company, PC, Certified Public Accountants, helping businesses, individuals, and nonprofit organizations make financial decisions based on their personal values since 1987. Wilkin and Company is located at 2435 Southwest 225-1359 or wilkincpas.com.
Good morning and welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. 2 years after Hurricane Sandy tore a swath of destruction and death across the Northeast, one haunting question remains. Was it a freak of nature, or was this devastating catastrophe a harbinger of what's to come? This morning we talk with scientist Adam Sobel, author of Storm Surge, Hurricane Sandy, Our Changing Climate, and the Extreme Weather of the Past and Future, about what this unprecedented megastorm means for the future of our planet. Adam is a leading scientist in the study of hurricanes and changing climate and a professor at Columbia University. Adam, welcome to Locus Focus.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, you talk in your book, you actually have a very interesting comment where you say that if Hurricane Sandy hadn't hit New York, we wouldn't be talking about it today. You wouldn't have written the book and I wouldn't be reading it. And I wonder why you say that. And also it's coupled with another thing that you say a little bit later in that paragraph about hurricanes are boring, which might be a surprise to some people.
Well, right. The quote that hurricanes are boring and the other quote you mentioned is from the chapter of the book that's about the Caribbean and other places where being hit by a very destructive hurricane is a relatively common occurrence. In the history of the Caribbean, the hurricanes are frequent. They cause a lot of destruction. The Spanish, when they first came, had never seen anything like them, but the colonists soon got used to them, and in fact the first disaster relief was colonists going back to Europe asking for help when there were hurricanes. That was the first real overseas disaster relief in the world. And so the point I was trying to make in that chapter is that, in some places we just sort of take for granted that these destructive events are going to happen frequently, and maybe we shouldn't. They do long-term harm, and maybe we should learn how to better handle them in those places where they're frequent. But what made Sandy unusual was the extent of the destruction from a hurricane in New York City, which is not only a place where they don't happen very frequently, although they have in the past, but pretty infrequently that we get a bad one. And also that it's a very highly populated and wealthy and all the media are there. It's a very high profile place. And so, it just draws more attention, and I think it's important to be realistic about that. It's not to say that's the way things should be, but it's important to understand that a disaster is not just the natural event, but it's a combination of the natural event and the human society, the human infrastructure that it happens to, that makes it what it is. And I think Sandy changed a lot of our consciousness, but it did that because of where it happened.
Well, we'll get into some of just how much it changed even the political landscape in a little bit. But I wanted to talk, before we get into what made Hurricane Sandy kind of a unique weather system, I wanted to talk a little bit more about what causes hurricanes. And sort of a sideline to that, there's been a lot of talk, particularly since Katrina, which is now pushing 10 years ago, about how climate change is going to exacerbate hurricanes, make them more frequent, making them more intense. And yet it's been very, very hard for scientists to pin the cause of any particular hurricane on climate change. So let's talk about what causes hurricanes and why it's so hard to decide which hurricane is being caused by climate change.
Right. So there are several different issues you raised, and it's worth trying to separate them. To start off, a hurricane is the Atlantic term for a tropical cyclone is the generic scientific term. They're called typhoons in the Western Pacific, and just cyclones or tropical cyclones in other places, especially the Southern Hemisphere, where, by the way, there's a whole bunch of them right now, and tiny Pacific island nation of Vanuatu was just completely clobbered by a Category 5 storm. But anyway, a tropical cyclone forms in the tropics. It gets its energy from the warm tropical ocean being overlain by a cooler atmosphere. And it's a way for the climate system to bring heat out of the ocean and into the atmosphere very efficiently. And as it does that, combined with the rotation of the Earth, you can generate these very powerful storms where you generate a strong rotation of the winds, and they're very destructive, and they have a bunch of other features that distinguish them from the storms we get at higher latitudes, such as the type you would get here in the Pacific Northwest. You can get some strong storms here in winter, but they're not hurricanes. They're extratropical storms or cyclones, and they have a different structure than hurricanes do, and they get their energy in different from different sources for the most part. So hurricanes, we can come back to that if you want, but to get into the climate change issue, hurricanes naturally fluctuate year to year. There's a globally they're about around 90 per year, plus or minus 10 or so. Those are distributed unevenly. The Atlantic has something like 10 per year, although that fluctuates quite a lot as well. About 10 tropical cyclones, that is, the number that actually reach hurricane status, which is means winds of at least 65 knots at the surface is a somewhat smaller number, but it fluctuates up and down. And there's a tremendous amount of variability, especially in the Atlantic, there's a tremendous amount of variability year to year, and even decade to decade. And that makes it hard to see long-term trends, right? Because if there's trends due to climate change, then you would expect to see over time the number or the intensities of hurricanes changing. But because there's so much natural fluctuation, and the data record that we have doesn't go back that far, and it deteriorates as you get further back in time, and the scientific measurements weren't as comprehensive. It's hard to, we can't really easily see human-induced trends in hurricanes yet. There are some studies that claim that we can see those changes, but I think the scientific literature is still in a state of debate about that. But it doesn't mean that they aren't changing. It means that or that we don't know anything about them. It just means that there's a lot of natural variability. But I think, so in the face of that, we have to use what we understand about hurricanes to estimate what we expect climate change to be doing. It doesn't only come from the observations. It comes from knowing how hurricanes work and having good models that can simulate how they respond to climate change. And what we think, after a lot of research, which has made a lot of progress in the last decade or so, a lot of it sparked by Katrina, as you mentioned, what we think is happening is that hurricanes are getting more intense, and we expect them to get more intense as the climate warms. It's not at all clear that they're getting more frequent. In fact, the latest models suggest that we're likely to have fewer hurricanes in the future rather than more hurricanes, although that's uncertain as well. And it's important to qualify that by saying that if they're getting more intense, then what could well happen is we still have more of the most intense hurricanes and fewer of the weak ones, which wouldn't be good news for hardly anyone. So I don't know. That there's a lot of different issues there, but I think, and that, you know, then the last thing is about how why we can't assign a given hurricane to global warming. I mean, I think it's always difficult. Climate change, climate is the average of the weather, right? It's the average over many, many days, many weather events. And so with all the hurricanes are rare events, and with any rare event, it's difficult to assign an explicit role to climate change in that one event. It's not that it can't quite be done. You can make probabilistic statements, like you can say such and such an event was some factor more likely because of climate change. So, for example, some studies have shown pretty well that the 2013 heat wave in Australia, which was an awful heat wave, was several times more likely to have occurred in our current climate than it would have if we hadn't had some amount of climate change already. But those type of statements are more difficult to make with hurricanes because they're rarer events and the models we have to make those kind of statements are not as good. So it creates a communication problem because it's difficult for scientists to defend precise statements about how much role climate change played in a given hurricane. And yet at the same time, we do know that our risk is increasing with a fair degree of confidence. So it's that creates a communication problem, but it doesn't, I mean, and as well as there being science problems.
Well, I found it interesting in the wake of Hurricane Sandy that there were a lot of people who were pinning that on climate change. And in fact, you mentioned in your book, most notably, then Mayor Bloomberg of New York switched his allegiance from Republicans to Democrats and endorsed Barack Obama a week before the national presidential election because he didn't believe that Obama's opponent was taking climate change seriously. So what's your thoughts? As a scientist, how did you feel watching actually Chris Christie also to a lesser degree, but politicians and other people pointing to this awesome meteorological event as an example of why we need to take climate change more seriously?
Yeah, I mean, I think that those were reasonable reactions, actually. I mean, Christie, I don't know if he's quite a climate change denier. He's sort of certainly avoided making any strong statements supporting the science, which I really wish he would, but he has not. But he did behave like an adult during Sandy and worked with Obama, so that was good. But Bloomberg's statement, I actually thought, if you look at what he actually said, I thought he made a lot of sense. And it's worth saying that Bloomberg was, for some time before this, one of our most proactive government officials on climate change, really pushing the city to take it seriously. And certainly very aware of the science. And if you look at what Bloomberg said, he didn't say climate change caused Hurricane Sandy. He said something, well, I don't remember the exact words, but he said something like, well, this event happened and we can't say exactly how much it's due to climate change, but it doesn't matter because we know that our risks are increasing and this is a serious problem. And I know that one of these two guys, referring to Obama and Romney, one of these two guys is better on this issue than the other, and it's such an important issue that I'm supporting Obama. And I thought that was quite a reasonable way to look at it. I mean, I think he got the bottom line right there. I mean, it's not, first of all, climate change did have a role in Sandy, in this, at least in that the sea level has risen about a foot in the New York area in the last 100 years, of which more than half of that is due to the warming climate. And with this total storm surge of 9 feet, total water level of 14 feet above low tide, a foot is not, on top, you know, the extra foot or 8 inches that you can ascribe to climate is not nothing. And we know that risk is increasing. So even though with all the uncertainty around hurricanes and climate change, it's important to understand that in coastal cities that can be hit by hurricanes, the risk of coastal floods like Sandy is definitely increasing because of sea level rise. Even if the hurricanes don't change at all, each one starting at a higher water level. And so that risk is certainly, you know, we can say that with little uncertainty. I mean, plenty of uncertainty about exactly the rate of sea level rise, but no uncertainty that the rise is happening and significant and increasing our risk of coastal floods. So that's the first thing. But secondly, you know, what Bloomberg was saying, I think, is that whether we can ascribe each individual event, you know, in a precise way to climate change is sort of missing the point. We know that the risks are increasing, and we know that we're severely underreacting to those increasing risks, and we need to be doing more. And these events, these extreme events, remind us how vulnerable we are to those risks. And so, you know, I think he basically got the story right.
Well, if you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning with Adam Sobel, who's author of Storm Surge, Hurricane Sandy, Our Changing Climate and the Extreme Weather of the Past and Future. And we're talking this morning about how much, what we can learn about what lies ahead from the lessons from Hurricane Sandy. Well, when I started tracking the hurricane back when it was still in the Caribbean, it was being called Hurricane Sandy. By the time it started heading towards the Northeast, it was being called Superstorm or some other great apocalyptic names. And at the time, I just thought it was more media hype. But I learned in your book that there was a big difference between what landed in New York and what's a classic hurricane. So what did the appellation Superstorm really mean, or when it was also called a hybrid storm?
Yeah, I mean, it both did and didn't. Both was and was not substantially different from a hurricane. I mean, what was happening was that as Hurricane Sandy came north, it transitioned from, it was in the process of transitioning from being a true tropical cyclone to an extratropical storm, which is a typical winter type of storm. A tropical cyclone, again, gets its energy from the warm ocean and the cooler atmosphere. It has some other properties. It tends to be warm in the core, warm in the center compared to the air around it, and to have a circularly symmetric shape and deep convection, which means strong thunderstorm-type clouds rising in an eye wall, the ring around the eye in the middle in a sort of circular symmetry, whereas a typical winter storm gets its energy from the jet stream, or an equivalent way to say that is it gets its energy from the difference between the warm tropics and the cold pole, and it tends to not be symmetric, tends to not have a circular structure quite as much, and it also tends to be cold in the middle rather than warm. So oftentimes it happens as hurricanes come north in the northern hemisphere that they, if they get to high enough latitude, they start undergoing this transition and they change the type of storm they are. They can still be quite powerful, maybe not as powerful as the most powerful hurricanes, but Sandy wasn't the most powerful of hurricanes. It was a modest hurricane. At its peak, it was briefly Category 3 over Cuba on the Saffir-Simpson scale, which goes up to 5. But it was more like 1 as it was coming up the coast, Category 1. But it had become very large in the process of this extratropical transition, which was really a sort of merger that Sandy underwent with a winter type of storm that was coming from the continent. Actually, it did it twice. It interacted with one other storm as it was around the Bahamas, which made it enlarge itself to become a very large hurricane, and then it interacted with a second one as it was making landfall. And it was called Superstorm, so the interesting thing is that we have one hurricane center that issues forecasts for all hurricanes, but if it's technically not a hurricane, then it's not the hurricane center's job anymore. And so it became this tricky meteorological issue where the Hurricane Center was forecasting that it was going to be a very destructive storm, but technically not a hurricane. And so they couldn't issue hurricane warnings. The responsibility for the warnings was going to be turned over to the local forecast offices, which can't call it a hurricane. And so even though everybody knew it was going to be a very destructive storm, because it was so large as well as powerful, it had the potential to cause great storm surge, but it couldn't be called a hurricane. But calling it post-tropical, the Hurricane Center was calling it a post-tropical storm. That's their word for it when it's been a hurricane, but it's changing into this other type of storm. That makes it sound not that dangerous to people. And you could tell from Bloomberg's early press conferences, for example, that the New York City local government was confused and at first thought it wasn't going to be that bad because of this. And so Superstorm was a media name. I mean, I don't know the genesis of it, but it became a name that the media used to convey the seriousness of it, given that they felt that the official warnings weren't serious enough, even though if you read the warnings carefully, they said this is going to be awful, but they also didn't call it a hurricane. And so Superstorm was a name that was designed, I think, by the Weather Channel, may have been who came up with it first or who first popularized it, to communicate. It's a word they made up, but it was meant to stand in for hurricane. They couldn't call it hurricane, or they thought that by the time it made landfall that they wouldn't be able to call it hurricane. So they called it Superstorm, and so, that was effective. It's worth saying, by the way, that the NOAA's policy has changed, by the way. They knew that this was a problem at the time, but they felt that they had to follow their rules. But now, if Sandy were to happen again, they would issue hurricane warnings through landfall, because the policy has changed such that they can do that with a transitioning storm now.
Well, I find it interesting that for once media hysteria actually was a responsible act in terms of like alerting communities to the dangers of the storm that was coming towards them.
Yes, I think so.
Unusual. Well, what I found it interesting, you describe how well the storm was forecast, and that, I mean, at first there was a debate about whether it was going to head into the Atlantic Ocean or whether it was going to veer back towards the northeast of the United States. But as well forecast as it was, it still seemed like that most communities are pretty unprepared for it. And I wonder why you think that is.
Well, I think there was a combination of things. The first of all, as you mentioned about media hype, I mean, there had been Irene the year before, another hurricane that had been, it's hard for us to remember it now, but the media hype in New York City was about as big as it was for Sandy, and then it turned out to not be so bad in the city. It actually was incredibly destructive upstate and in New England as a rain-driven flooding event caused huge destruction. But New York City got off easy with Irene. And that having happened just the year before, I think some people who should have evacuated or taken other serious measures didn't take them because they had become complacent after hearing similar hype the year before and having nothing happen. But, I think in terms of people being unprepared, I think most of the local government and state and federal government actions were pretty good. I mean, you can look back on it and find mistakes. Some decisions were made later than they should have been. The city didn't evacuate nursing homes, which they probably should have done. I mean, definitely should have done in hindsight. But mostly, I mean, if you compare it to Katrina, for example, it was a tremendously good emergency response. The evacuations and the subway closures and the transit shutdowns, all that got people out of harm's way, as well as, they could, given our procedures in the U.S. where mandatory evacuations really aren't mandatory. They're up to the people to do it, and some people didn't take it seriously enough. But I think the longer-term issue is the infrastructure. I mean, when we say prepared, there's two kinds of preparation. There's the preparation you do when the forecast is telling you that there's a storm coming your way, and that's maybe you have a few days. And it's what do you do then? But there's also how is the city built? Is the infrastructure prepared? And the answer is it really wasn't. So the subway flooding, for example, I mean, the MTA hammered plywood over the subway entrances, and that just didn't cut it. There was nothing they could do. They also did some other heroic things. They went and pulled out electrical signals from the subway tunnels, excuse me, which made the subways come back after being flooded much more quickly than they would have, because once they got the water out, they could put the electrical signals back in, and they hadn't been damaged. But that's what they could do in the few days before. The better thing to do would have been to build the system in a way that it wouldn't be flooded in the first place, to raise up the entrances or to have some way of plugging them so that they wouldn't fill with water, and that would have taken a longer-term infrastructure investment. Similarly, the power went out for half of Manhattan because there were the flood walls around the transformers in the Lower East Side weren't high enough. And now those have been raised, but, I mean, that investment wasn't made until after the fact. And I think it's not because people didn't know the risk was there. There's documentation that's quite clear that going back at something like 20 years at least, that scientists and government officials knew that an event like this was probably going to happen eventually, although we couldn't say when. And it would have been a good idea to invest more in making the infrastructure more floodproof, but that didn't happen because it hadn't happened in anybody's recent memory. It seemed sort of a vague risk far in the future. And so even though I think all the scientific warning, I mean, all the documentation of the risk that had gone on, there had been studies of what could happen if a hurricane flooded New York City, those studies did inform the good emergency response. I mean, I think that's why you saw the subway closures and the evacuations and all those things. Those are the right things to do, and the government officials knew what to do because they did know the science, but they didn't make the longer-term investments over the years before that. And that's, I think, where the biggest failure was. And I think, you know, a lot of that is happening now in New York City. Now that the disaster has happened, I mean, people, we tend to be reactive as a species, and when a disaster happens, we get better at preparing for the next one. But I think what we have to worry about, especially in the changing climate, is the disasters that haven't happened yet, and that where we're not taking the scientific information about the risks seriously enough.
Well, I think when we look at all many major cities around the world that are coastal cities like New York City, and you look at the infrastructure, it seems to be an almost insurmountable problem. Like, how do you... how would you build cities the size and scope of New York that could really resist storms, major storms and hurricanes? I mean, that's a big enough problem. But even worse than that is, how do you retrofit cities that were built with kind of a denial of nature, the way the edifices that stand right at the coast? And as a person who lived in New York for a number of years, I mean, I just watched in amazement looking at what was happening. The most visual thing was, of course, seeing the subways flood, but there were many, many other aspects. Also seeing lower Manhattan darkened for days on end. And having lived in New York, my own private blackout once because of a problem with Con Ed, I know what it's like to live in New York City without electricity. And it's much harder than many other places in the world. So looking at that, it just felt like just watching the city be crippled and being this incredible giant that had just been kind of taken down. I wonder what your thoughts are about, is it possible to really transform New York into a city that could be truly resilient in the face of what are going to be probably more likely this kind of flooding and storm happening again?
Well, it's obviously the many billion dollar question. There's certainly serious effort underway in the city to try and address it. And I think there's a lot of things that can be done. And then there's other things that are harder to do. So, for example, I think retrofitting the subways to be floodproof is an expensive but doable undertaking. Protecting the power, so that it doesn't go out so easily in a flood is certainly doable, and some of it's already been done. Other infrastructure like sewage treatment plants, which most of which were taken down by Sandy, those can be retrofitted. I think there's a lot that can be done, and that is being done, so that future disasters won't be as bad. But I think the issue you're raising, that's more serious for the long term, is some of the most vulnerable areas that are really so low to the water, where it's very difficult to get people out. So, for example, Staten Island, some of those neighborhoods that flooded, the Rockaways. Staten Island is the area that flooded were historically wetlands that weren't built on until sometime in mid-20th century in some cases. The Rockaways Barrier Island, which is basically a glorified sand dune left over from the last ice age, never meant to be permanent. Those things are always pushed around by the waves, but you know, once buildings get built on them, then we have to try to hold them in place. Lower Manhattan, a lot of that area that flooded was landfill. Around South Street Seaport, the water got up to a street called Water Street, which is called that because it's where the coast used to be till the Dutch and English filled it out. So it's all, when you said something like, you know, living in denial of nature, you got it right. I mean, the places that flooded were all places that are naturally close to the water and sort of close to being flooded all the time. And now we've got so many people living on those. I think, you know, we can do better at flood-proofing the subways and the power grid, but perhaps the most serious problem is these really low-lying areas where it's in the long term, with sea level rise, there may be no alternative but to retreat from some of those areas, and that's the one thing the city isn't seriously considering doing. The Bloomberg administration put out a very ambitious and serious plan post Sandy called the SIRR report, which I forget what the acronym stands for, but I think resiliency and recovery is the two R's, that's being implemented now under the new mayor for what to do. But the one thing they said is we can't retreat from the waterfront. There's been a lot of investment in New York waterfront over the last few decades. Everybody loves it. You know, it's more accessible to people. There's parks and everything. But sea level rises enough, you may have to retreat from some of those places, and that's not being seriously considered yet, and it's very difficult given how valuable the real estate is, how many people are living there. And the buyout, there were very, very limited buyouts proposed by New York State and to try to get people out of the absolute worst, hard-hit, most vulnerable neighborhoods. And even those are only being, it's just an article in New York Times today, those are only being taken up in a very limited degree. Most people are still trying to stay in those areas, which for the short term may be tenable. Another Sandy's probably not going to hit that soon, most likely. But a couple feet of sea level rise and it becomes a different story. So it is a serious problem. I mean, there was a report just written by a NOAA scientist about what would have happened if Sandy had hit Washington, D.C. And one conclusion was it wouldn't be as bad because a lot of the low-lying waterfront in D.C. is parks, which can be flooded and doesn't hurt anything, really. And I thought that was real interesting. I don't know if that was done consciously by design, but, if to the extent it's true, it means that D.C. needs less retrofitting, and if somebody did that consciously, then good for them.
Well, actually, my recollection of D.C. is a lot of the building is on the highlands, and I mean, D.C. was even more of a swamp than New York City before it was built.
Yeah.
So I do think that you think about Capitol Hill and you think about a lot of the other neighborhoods and communities that are either government-centered or they're residential, and it's not quite the same as New York, which has so many low-lying neighborhoods that are below sea level. Well, if you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning with Adam Sobel, who's author of Storm Surge, Hurricane Sandy, Our Changing Climate, and the Extreme Weather of the Past and Future. Well, there's been a lot of talk here in Portland for the last many years about dealing with a lot of our water issues and climate change issues by building green infrastructure. And the city's now doing kind of a combination of green infrastructure and also doing the gray infrastructure of replacing failing sewer pipes, but not being so reliant on the hardscape and working more on building swales and trying to renaturalize areas along the river. And I've heard some stories about there being some movement afoot in New York to sort of restore wetlands in lower Manhattan to some degree. Do you think is that still being talked about? And do you think there's any possibility of that gaining any traction?
In lower Manhattan, I should know the status of this because my wife, who is in fact a Portland native, so I've been to your city many times, is the director of wetlands restoration for the New York City Parks. So I should know more about wetlands restoration than I do. There has been a tremendous amount of wetland restoration in New York City in the last couple of decades, but most of it, in fact all of it that I know of, not in Manhattan. The city has wetlands in the Bronx and Staten Island, Brooklyn and Queens. Lower Manhattan, there is a lot of going on now. There's a project called Rebuild by Design, and it wouldn't be, and I believe there are, there may be some wetlands as part of that, but I haven't kept up, I'm sorry to say, with the latest of it. I think it is a different issue in New York than in Portland, though, because in New York, the concern is coastal flooding, is the sea coming up. I think there's a possibility for some of that in Portland, but I don't think that's the concern that you guys have the most, right? Because it's a fairly hilly city. Isn't it mostly stormwater that's the issue?
Well, it's stormwater, but it's also a lot of flooding. We have a lot of streams, and on the east side of Portland, a lot of the streams have been culverted. So when we have a big flood, like we actually didn't have a big flood in the last couple of days, but we had major rainfall and flooding happens, and a lot of those underground creeks start to come up to the surface, particularly close in by the Willamette River. Actually, yesterday I saw an interesting thing which made me think about the importance of green infrastructure. After this big windstorm and rainstorm that we had, I was driving in my neighborhood right along this park and had a go out of my way because there was a giant tree that had come down and had come down across the street from the park into the park. And I thought, isn't it fortunate this tree came down in the park and basically just destroyed a flower bed as opposed to a tree from across the street on the park side falling the other way and hitting a house. And it just made me think about the importance of having parkland and natural spaces in the city to absorb some of the force of storms.
Yes. Yes, and Portland is obviously a leader in this kind of green infrastructure. We all know that,
I mean, actually, where I live, we actually have a beach along the river, and there's a wetland, and it's all the kinds of stuff that was saved by a lot of neighborhood agitation and a little bit by accident and neglect. And it's a beautiful natural resource. But I look at the rest of the city and think, I mean, in my neighborhood, when there's a big flood, it is absorbed by natural areas. But there's a lot of other parts of Portland where it's not absorbed. And in New York, obviously, there's very little space for it to be absorbed, which actually gets me to my next questions. I want to move out from the city for the remaining minutes and talk about the Barrier Islands and what happened there, because that's another place where you describe what barrier islands are. You mentioned it real briefly. Maybe we can talk a bit more about what their role is in nature and how that role is denied when we start to build on them.
Right. A barrier island is our leftovers. You know, in the last ice age, sea level was much lower than it is today by something like 100 meters or more. So the barrier islands were, the coast was much farther out, and the barrier islands were sort of like sand dunes at the end of a beach. And then as the sea level rises, it fills, you know, the coast retreats, but the barrier islands, this dune is sort of left out as a little island that's basically just made out of sand. There's nothing hard holding them in place. I'm not a coastal geologist, but that's my summary of what I've learned from talking to the people who are. And so they really are just leftover sand dunes, and it's as the sea level is rising, not just now due to climate change, by the way, but naturally as we recover from the last ice age. There's been, you know, there was a lot of sea level rise as the glaciers melted coming out of the last ice age. And those islands are, in many cases, migrating back towards the land. What happens with it is the waves, when there's big storms, the waves are always stripping sand off the beaches and moving around, and sometimes they're moved along the island, sometimes they're ripped off the island and pulled out into the open sea, and then it can often come back. But then what can happen in a big storm like Sandy is that the storm can take sand and blow it back to the backside, the lagoon side, towards the mainland of the barrier island. And when that happens, the whole island migrates towards the land, and eventually they can disappear, basically merging with the continent again. One coastal geologist, Cheryl Happy, who works for the USGS, did some measurements right after Sandy that estimated that the peak of Fire Island, which is on one of the barrier islands on the New York side off Long Island, moved 60 feet landward as a result of Sandy. Just one storm moved the height of land 60 feet back. And so we have the barrier islands all along Long Island. We have them all down the Jersey Shore. Some of the most devastated areas in Sandy were along the Jersey Shore, both some widely economically diverse areas, some very wealthy areas of million-dollar homes, and also some much more working-class areas equally devastated. But I think that the main point is that these barrier islands are perhaps even more than wetlands, are an example of places that really, if we knew it was good for us, we wouldn't build houses there. I mean, they're just naturally moving around. Even without climate change, they would be, without human-induced climate change, they would be moving always as storms and waves move the sand around, and sea level rise due to human activity is only exacerbating that, and is very rapid, by the way. The sea level rise that we're causing is very quick compared to that coming out of the last ice age, so it's even harder for the going to be even harder for these fragile systems to adjust to. But once we build on them, then, you know, there's a political and social investment in keeping them there, and that's why there's, you know, the Army Corps has built so much artificial dunes and groins and breakwaters and seawalls and everything. And if we want people's houses to stay where they are, we have to keep doing that, but it becomes expensive and you know, a very difficult political problem. It's hard to tell people that they can't live there. None of us really wants to be in the position of telling people that they can't stay in their home. But at the same time, you know, there may become a point at which it's untenable. So it's a difficult problem.
Well, I wonder how we find a solution, because it seems that we are really heading towards a time when all these difficult problems are going to become so difficult that there's going to the solutions that might be found at that point would be very distasteful for a very lot of people if we don't plan ahead now.
Yeah, well, I think one thing we could do, I mean, flood insurance through the National Flood Insurance Program, which is administered by FEMA, is of course artificially cheap. It's basically subsidized by the rest of the country that doesn't live in flood zones are subsidizing those who do. And there was a Biggert Waters Act was passed in right before Sandy. One of the most ineffective Congresses managed to pass an act to raise flood insurance rates. The right liked it because it was reducing government subsidies. The left liked it because it was admitting environmental risks and climate change risks. And then it got reversed after Sandy when people saw how much their rates were going to go up. It got reversed, and not completely reversed, but mostly reversed. But I think that would be the first thing we could do is make insurance a little less cheap. Of course, you don't want to drive people out of their homes if someone's can only afford to live it. If someone's been somewhere for a long time and they'll be forced out by flood insurance going up, you don't want to do that. But at least on new construction and on people who can afford it, I think one can make a pretty good argument that we shouldn't be subsidizing artificially cheap flood insurance. That would be one thing we could do, at least to slow down growth in some of these areas. And beyond that, yeah, it's just one of many dimensions of the climate change problem that I think we're only beginning to wake up to in this country.
Well, I guess this will be a continuing saga. Maybe we'll check back in a while and see how we're doing.
Yeah.
Well, I want to thank you very much for joining us, Adam. It's been good talking to you. I enjoyed reading your book. And I think Sandy is something that we need to keep thinking about as the climate keeps changing and our weather keeps getting stranger.
Thanks. If I could mention, I'm speaking about this in Reed College on Thursday evening.
Oh, great.
7 o'clock, if anybody's interested.
7 o'clock this Thursday?
This Thursday, Reed College. You can find the information online. I think it was in the Portland Mercury. I don't remember the name of the hall, but yes, Reed College at 7 o'clock Thursday evening.
Great.
Southeast Portland.
Okay. Well, hope people can come out and hear you. Thanks a whole lot.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks for joining us. We've been talking this morning with Adam Sobel, who's author of Storm Surge, and you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locusfocus. Next week, we'll talk with Elise Higley with our Family Farms Coalition in Southern Oregon about the lawsuit challenging the anti-GMO measure that passed by a wide margin last spring in Jackson County. My engineer is Kate Welch. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go out with some music by Tom Waits. Thanks for listening.
All right. London Bridge is falling down. Stranger woman tries to save all that a man will try to drown. And it's the rain that they predicted. It's the forecast every time. The roses died because you picked it. I'm out here. It's the same, it's the same. And the world is getting flatter, and the sky is falling all around. Oh, and nothing is the matter, for I never cry. A love like ours, my dear, is best measured when it's down. And I never buy umbrellas, 'cause there's always one around. And all over the world, strangers talk only about the weather. It's the same.
it's the end. Once again, we are strangers as the fog goes rolling in. And you're over. Go live out the weather.
Hey, Tom Waits. Coming up at 11, stay tuned for Health Watch, hosted by Dr. David Naiman. His guest will be Dr. Sarah Gottfried, the author of The Hormone Reset Diet. And then at 11:30 on the Radio Zine, host Stephanie Potter will speak with Jane Miller. She's the founder of the Oregon Cougar Action Team, and they are urging the Oregon Legislature and the Oregon Department of Wildlife to support a cougar management plan that respects voter opposition to hunting cougar with hounds. And thank you, KABU members, for your generous support. If you're not a KABU member, you can still become one. Go to KBOO.FM and click on Donate Today. It is 11 a.m. You are tuned to KBOO in Portland.
KABU Community Radio invites you to our springtime open house and live in-studio performance of Mama C, Saturday, March 21st, from 1 to 5 p.m. Welcome, welcome. Tour the KABU studios and meet your community. Share refreshments and talk with other listeners, program hosts, volunteers, and KABU staff. See how our communities intersect and work together to create this amazing community radio station. We'll also have a live performance by Mama C, an accomplished musician, poet, and MC, as well as a former Black Panther and political refugee who fled the U.S. in early 1970s for Tanzania. Again, that's Saturday, March 21st, from 1 to 5 p.m., an open house and live performance by Mama C at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, your community.